Hi, and we have a themeless pod today for totally unrelated items. Unrelated, of course, except for the language thing. Or in the case of the final segment, maybe it's a pre-language thing, as one of the scientists thinks. Here's the subject. Before that, a little music, please, Maestro.
We meet every day at the same cafe, 6:30, and no one knows.
Ah, yes. This was a song that, as a child, I listened to, kind of whether I liked it or not. It was on the radio. It's a perfectly good song, Me and Mrs. Jones, sung by Billy Paul. And it's got this nice, emotionally climactic chorus.
Mrs. Jones, we got a thing going on.
Now this song, I guess because of all the repeated listenings and because of the nature of the song somehow, It would get stuck in my head. You have that, right? What seems like a fairly random piece of music, nothing that you especially care about, it just gets stuck in your head and you can't get it out. Maybe it's the words, maybe we're getting in touch with a time before words, before language, when there were just sounds. We're going to hear some possible explanations in today's pod for what's going on when you do get something stuck in your head like this. What we won't hear, perhaps luckily, is an explanation for my own childhood obsession with this particular song. Because it was not the whole song. No. It was much worse than that. It was just this bit.
Mrs.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to my own private Idaho. And now, for the second week in a row, last week it was Puff the Magic Dragon, for the second week, I ask myself, why am I putting you through this? Well, first I'll put you through some other stories. We have stories today on a new / old expression in Hebrew, all will be revealed. And as well as that music in your head investigation, we have news of a possible neurological breakthrough. Scientists believe they have discovered a way, a pathway at least, to decoding thought. So you get audio readouts like this.
Structure.
Town.
Okay, so there's still plenty of work to do before they can read your mind. Before all of that, though, you may have heard about a new TV service launched a few days ago, as I speak, in Latin America. It's called Hispan TV. It is a 24-hour news channel in Spanish. So what, you may think? Well, it's based in Iran, and it's run by the government there. Here's how Iran's president Ahmadinejad sees it. Hispan TV will, quote, counter the influence of dominance seekers in Latin America. I wonder who he's talking about. One of the big questions about this, and many other foreign language TV channels run by various governments, is are they going to find an audience? Here's a report from the BBC's Vincent Dowd.
There are more than 350 million Spanish speakers in Latin America. To reach even a small percentage with Hispan TV would be a real achievement for Iran. So Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was on hand this week to help launch the channel.
Viva la paz. Viva de justicia. Viva el pueblo. Viva América Latina.
Leonardo Ferreira, professor of communications at the University of Miami, says audiences will be interested, at least initially.
Latin Americans receive different voices well because if you look at most of the countries, they have a structure in which from the print press to the TV are influenced by major economic interests and major conglomerates and players. So anything that comes from outside at least sparks interest and curiosity.
Professor Ferreira says Latin America has a huge appetite for news. Even the rival NTN 24 led on the channel's launch.
El informativo.
Irán lanza su canal de televisión en español. El presidente Mahmoud Ahmadinejad ha inaugurado Hispan TV. Va a contar con periodistas.
But can an Iranian channel match the impact of NTN or of Venezuela's Telesur, which Washington says is largely a vehicle for Hugo Chavez? Professor Javier Protzel of the University of Lima in Peru.
I think that what they would try to do would go to have a channel which is counter-hegemonic. But Venezuela and Telesur belong to Latin American countries. That would necessarily mean more openness. What I see in Iran now is that they are getting tighter and tighter and tighter, with more censorship.
The new service is modelled in part on Press TV, since 2007, Tehran's channel in English. Last month, it had its licence revoked in Britain after what the regulator called a serious breach of the broadcasting code. Press TV says that was blatant censorship.
British media regulator Ofcom has revoked Press TV's UK licence. I'm Kavitak Vayan, and this news
the analysis. Iranian-born journalist whose complaint began the process believes Press TV did start out with some good intentions.
I'm Azir Bahari, journalist and filmmaker. Press TV originally started as a smart propaganda channel for the Iranian government. They tried to look neutral, but during the June 2009 presidential election, something changed. The people in charge of Press TV in Tehran, they were under a lot of pressure by the Revolutionary Guards and by the security apparatus to show Iranian propaganda. So it has become Iranian government's propaganda channel. And they are hiring certain, how can we say, useful idiots all around the world who repeat Iranian propaganda because of certain, maybe sometimes genuine grievances.
Press TV in London declined to appear in this piece, but said it was clear institutions, including the British Foreign Office, couldn't tolerate an alternative view. Thus far, Latin American governments are welcoming its new sister operation. Washington, of course, remains sensitive about attempts by Iran to reach out to Latin America. But Professor Leonardo Ferreira says that wariness can be counterproductive.
Here is the U.S. saying this is good, this is bad. Latin Americans being very rebellious in some respects, it has a long tradition of that. Then we always take with caution this reaction. Telesur was badly received in 2005 by the United States, the Bush administration, just as the Iranian service right now is badly received by Obama. And these are two very different administrations.
Hola, buenas, ¿qué tal? Comenzamos en Irán. El régimen de la República Islámica ha inaugurado...
For now, the fact that Iran has started a TV news service for Latin America is itself news. But analyst Steve Metcalf of BBC Monitoring says few of us realise how many international TV news channels are now planned.
The Chinese are expanding the number of languages they broadcast in. Al Jazeera just 2 months ago launched a channel specifically for the Balkans, and in a few months' time it's going to be launching a channel in Swahili aimed at East Africa, and there are other channels in the pipeline.
Steve Metcalf of BBC Monitoring, rather abruptly ending Vincent Dowd's report. Now to a great rival of Iran's, some would say enemy, actually a lot of people would say that, Israel. And there's a Hebrew phrase that's making headlines there right now. That is Hadarat Nashim. Loosely translated, it means the exclusion of women. The term is being used in the long-running and highly contentious debate between secular and ultra-Orthodox Jews over the public role of women. A lot of Israeli women, and it has to be said, not just secular women, they believe that they're being marginalized by ultra-Orthodox Jews who don't want women in the public sphere. It comes up pretty much every day now in Israeli life, which I guess is why Hadarat Nashim has become such a popular catchphrase. Reporter Daniel Estrin, who's in Jerusalem, he set out to learn just how this new Hebrew phrase was born.
Whenever I have a question about Hebrew, I go to the expert.
My name is Gabriel Birnbaum, Dr. Gabriel Birnbaum. I'm a senior researcher at the Academy of the Hebrew Language.
It's Israel's government-mandated body in charge of coining new Hebrew words.
Hebrew really has the unique history of not to be a spoken language for 1700 years, from 200 CE until about the end of the 19th century, and then it was revived.
Part of the Zionist movement's goal of establishing a Jewish homeland was picking a national language. They chose the language of Moses, but it's not easy speaking a biblical tongue in 2012.
We lack words. We lack words which are used in modern times.
So the Academy gathers professionals from various academic fields to sit down and come up with Hebrew words for things that didn't have names when Moses was around. Zoologists and linguists, for instance, just finished figuring out Hebrew names for each and every fish found off the shores of Israel. About 10 years ago, a committee of Israeli sociologists met at the Language Academy to find a Hebrew term for social exclusion. They looked to an ancient Jewish text called the Mishnah. Birnbaum leafs through one of the 63 volumes of Jewish law compiled almost 2,000 years ago. He shows me the word the sociologists picked, hadara. It's related to the Hebrew word neder, meaning vow, and it's often used in the Mishnah to talk in broad terms about the vows men make to their wives. For example, the Mishnah says, a husband can't vow to prevent his wife from wearing jewelry or visiting her parents. That's the ancient Jewish concept of hadara.
He can't be arbitrary with her. He can't, even in those days that really women were considered not equal. They weren't equal to her. We have to face it. But you see that still she had a lot of rights, and the Mishnah emphasizes it.
So Israeli sociologists adopted hadara to mean social exclusion. In the last few years, religious Jewish feminists started using it to describe the exclusion of women in some ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities. The term has now become a catchphrase in the Israeli press to describe recent examples of ultra-Orthodox Jews excluding or demeaning women. A little girl spat upon for not dressing modestly, a gynecology convention that banned women from speaking, a female professor prevented from accepting her prize on stage at a government award ceremony. All of this has been dubbed Hadarat Nashim, the exclusion of women. In the epicenter of ultra-Orthodox Jewish life in Israel, Jerusalem's Mea Shearim neighborhood, residents disagree with the semantics. Exclusion or absence of women, they say, doesn't describe their lifestyle, says one American-born man in the neighborhood.
It's not an absence of women. It's that women fulfill their roles and men fulfill theirs. That's the way we're taught, that women are not supposed to be running all around. It's women, they're quite happy with it. No one, they're not upset about it. They're very, that's their way of life.
And this is your wife?
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about women, so I feel like I should ask you your opinion.
She nervously eyed her husband.
I'd rather not.
Do you agree with what I said?
I agree with everything, 100%.
Religious feminist activist Hannah Kehat says that's nonsense.
Their life is discrimination of women, and we can't accept it. We can't let them take over all the public area of Israel. It's really a danger for women.
Linguists prefer not to take sides, but they're kind of excited that an ancient word is now back in everyday use. Here's Birnbaum from the Hebrew Language Academy.
We use all the sources, all the old sources, and we give some of the old words, we give them new meanings, and that's really something which is quite amazing, I think.
Now the worker bees at the Hebrew Language Academy have moved on from sociology to cyberspace. In recent weeks, pro-Palestinian and Israeli hackers have attacked each other's websites. Researchers at the Language Academy are begging Israeli media to stop using the English word hacker and start using the Academy's new Hebrew word, patzchan. It's related to the Hebrew word for nutcracker. Some broadcasters think the Academy is nuts, though they have compromised with the linguists. They're reporting the news using both words. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
Okay, the next story is potentially the stuff of paranoid science fiction, except that it's real. Well, what's real and what we may be projecting, that actually is an open question. Scientists at the University of California, Berkeley, believe that the first step has been taken toward hearing imagined speech using a form of electronic telepathy. In the future, they believe it's going to be possible to decode, whatever that means, the thoughts of brain-damaged patients who cannot speak. So here's a piece of tape, after which the BBC's John Humphreys will explain the setup.
Waldo?
Waldo?
Structure.
Structure.
Town.
Town.
Doubt. Doubt.
Property.
Now, what's happening there? It's quite extraordinary. You are hearing somebody's thoughts. The words were being listened to by somebody with electrodes attached to their brain, and then the brain waves, the word was first spoken, and it was heard by the person who then thought about it, as it were, and then his brain waves were turned into speech, very primitive speech, obviously, but potentially incredibly important. The man behind it all, Bob Knight, Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of California, Berkeley. In this particular case, the patient was being operated on, yep, and the brain, the sensors were attached to his brain, so the words were spoken to him, and they were, as it were, I'm not going to use very technical language, obviously, but they were kind of resonating in his brain, and the computer picked up that resonance, sort of?
Yes, the electrodes on his brain, which were being placed on his brain, basically for the treatment of for epilepsy surgery. These electrodes picked up the electrical signals produced by hearing the word, and the postdoctoral fellow who did the work, Brian Paisley, was able to reconstruct using computational methods the actual structure of the word. And you could hear it played back, obviously very crudely now, but this is really a first pass at this kind of work. And it's very exciting because it takes this ability to reconstruct brain activity from simple motor acts to some or higher level perceptual area. In this case, the word that you heard.
Mm. So you could sort of decode the thoughts of somebody who was so badly, whose brain was so badly damaged that they couldn't speak.
Well, that's the hope, because this is the first step. Now we can decode what you heard. So I would, if I said to you soccer, I would be able to record from your brain that you heard soccer. The next step, of course, is to see whether we can decode when you voluntarily, you don't hear me say soccer,
right,
but voluntarily think soccer. If we can get to that stage, which I think we can, if we can get to that stage, then, of course, you could have a prosthesis, an implantable device for someone who has a devastating neurological disorder that can't speak. For instance, in your own country, Stephen Hawkins has a severe motor deficit. His brain is obviously brilliant, but he can't get. He has no way to produce the sound. And if you could actually, if you could read his ideas, you could put it into a speech synthesizer, and he could speak. Similarly, people who have aphasia, language disorders from stroke and other neurological maladies, might benefit.
Is there any danger here that, in the long run, and clearly we're a very, very long way away from this, that something could be done, some sort of work could be done that would enable people with malign intent to find out what we're thinking? I'm thinking sort of Dr. Strangelove scenario here.
Well, I would never say never, but I would say that the biggest danger now is not doing this work because of the potential benefits for patients. So I think how Dr. Strangelove might use this in the future might be slightly above my pay grade. I'm going to focus on whether we can make this work for neurological patients.
Indeed. Well, it's...
I do understand the question, though.
Bob Knight of UC Berkeley speaking with the BBC's John Humphreys. Now, another scientific exploration. This one into music. Ah, music. As Henry Wadsworth Longfellow called it, the universal language of mankind. Okay, well, here's something else universal about music. Certain tunes, usually the uninvited ones, they get stuck in our heads. And don't worry now, I'm not going to play that me and Mrs. No, I'm not going to do that again. Suffice to say that we're all on the same page here, right? Here is my pod cousin, The Big Show's Ritu Chatterjee.
It was mid-morning on a Sunday several weeks ago when, for no apparent reason, this popped into my head. Funky Comodina. Now, I'm told this song by rapper Tone Loke was a hit in the 90s. But I'd never heard it until the night before when I was at a karaoke bar and my friend Jay sang it.
Cooling at a bar, and I'm looking for some action. But like Mick Jagger said, I can't get no satisfaction. The girls are all around.
When it reappeared in my head the next day, I could hear Jay singing the chorus again.
Funky Cole Medina.
And again.
Funky Cole Medina.
And again.
Funky Cole Medina.
I was stuck with the song for nearly a day and a half before it finally went away. But it left behind a nagging question. Why do we get songs stuck in our heads in the first place? I figured someone must be trying to find an answer.
My name is Dr. Vicky Williamson.
Williamson is a psychologist at Goldsmiths College in London. A few years ago, she became fascinated by tunes that stick in our heads.
I personally couldn't believe how little there was in terms of research on this phenomenon. It seemed to happen to me very frequently.
She found that scientists used a range of terms to describe the experience. Stuck song syndrome, sticky music. The most common was this, earworm. In 2009, Williamson collaborated with a BBC radio program in the UK and asked listeners to email and text their experiences with these so-called earworms.
My bloody earworm is that bloody George Harrison song you played yesterday.
I've got changes by David Bowie.
My earworm's still alive by Pearl Jam and has been for days.
Williamson collected more stories through an international online survey. Then she looked for patterns to understand what causes these tunes to automatically pop into our heads and stay there. She found several triggers.
The first one is music exposure, which means the person has heard the music recently.
No surprise there, that explains why I was stuck with Funky Cold Medina. Another unsurprising finding was that if you hear a song repeatedly, you're more likely to get stuck with it. But sometimes songs pop into our heads even when we haven't heard them for a long time. In this case, something in our current environment may trigger the memory of a song. Williamson experienced this herself recently when she was in her office and noticed an old shoebox.
And it's from a shop called Faith. And just by reading the word Faith, my memory went down a line of dominoes and eventually reached the song Faith by George Michael. And then he was in my head for the rest of the afternoon.
Williamson says she found another trigger, stress. One woman in Williamson's survey said this song first got stuck in her head when she was 16 and taking a big exam.
She now gets that song at every single moment of stress in her life. So wedding, childbirth, everything.
The song, by the way, is Nathan Jones by Bananarama. But why is it that music gets stuck in our heads? Why not lines from movies or TV shows or books? I asked neuroscientist Daniel Levitin of McGill University in Montreal. He's an expert on the neuroscience of music. He's been thinking about the phenomenon and he frequently experiences it.
There's a particular subway train that I ride sometimes, and as it's speeding up, it makes this interval, ba-da. Every time I hear the ba-da, I immediately think of da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I just can't help myself. And then I got that song stuck in my head for a while.
Levitin thinks there may be an evolutionary explanation for why music sticks in our brains. Modern humans have been around for some 200,000 years. But Levitin says written language may have been invented only 5,000 years ago.
So for a very long period of time, we needed to remember information, important information like where the well is or what foods are poisonous and which aren't, or how to care for a wound so that it won't become infected.
Levitin thinks for most of human history, people memorized this kind of information through songs. That practice continues today in cultures with strong oral traditions. Levitin says the combination of rhythm, rhyme, and melody provides reinforcing cues that make songs easier to remember than words alone.
So it may be the case that brains and music, in effect, selected each other, you know, through Darwinian natural selection and co-evolved in such a way that songs were intended to get stuck in our heads. And that's why we still have them. It's a vestige of that.
Of course, that's just a hunch. But he says the main question people ask him about the phenomenon of stuck songs is this.
How do we turn it off?
Levitin doesn't know, but he offers a piece of advice.
You just think of another song and hope that that'll push out the first one.
But then, of course, you might just end up with a new song stuck in your head. For The World, I'm Ritu Chatterjee.
You're You can check out Ritu's science podcast at theworld.org/science. And while you're at the mother site, check out theworld.org/language for my show notes and blog posts. There's also the Facebook page, The World in Words, and there's me on Twitter, tweeting all those language stories that nearly got away. My Twitter handle is Patrick Cox, P-A-T-R-I-C-O-X. Have a great week and talk soon.